sun. Thank you for feeding all living things on earth. Thank you, plant kingdom. Thank you, trees and plants, for converting the sun's light into edible foods that we can consume and digest, and for providing oxygen in the air that we breathe. Good morning, water. Thank you for being 75% of our body. We are one, and we bless you and protect you because we cannot live without you. Good morning, animal kingdom. Thank you for your companionship, your beauty and splendor, and for your sacrifice of life so that we may eat and live. Thank you, great spirit that moves in all things. Thank you for our lives and for the opportunity to be here and to be of service in this sacred earth garden of life. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Good morning and welcome to Shaman's Keep. It's a beautiful day today. Isn't it wonderful to be alive? The sun is shining, the flowers are blooming, the birds are singing. Something wonderful to give thanks for. I hope you've had a great week, and I'm very excited today to introduce you to a great guy. His name is Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., and you've probably read his father's book, The Four Agreements, which was just an awesome book. I still refer to it every so often because he really broke down the importance of really perceiving life clearly. And so Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. is following in his father's footsteps, teaching and writing about Toltec wisdom and the spiritual warrior's journey. He has a new book out himself, which builds on the Toltec principles found in his father's book, The Four Agreements. This is the next step in our evolutionary journey, as I see it, and the title of his new book is The Five Levels of Attachment. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. to Shaman's Keep. Thank you for joining us today, Don Miguel.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Caroline. It's a pleasure being here. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure, and I think I met you a few years ago, actually. Actually, it's been about 10 years ago. I think it was 2003 that I attended a class at Rita Rivera's house in San Diego. Oh. And your grandmother, Sarita, was there, and she spoke with us and did a demonstration of her healing methods. And I believe you were there translating for her.
I know exactly the date that happened, yes. I actually have pictures of that date. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness,
that
yes.
That is so cool. Yes. Yeah, I got the pictures. I got pictures from my uncle from that event, and I'm translating it, and we're gonna post it. And I'm like, it's so cool that you were there. It's so cool.
Yes.
Wow.
interesting how our paths have crossed again.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so cool. So, basically, you witnessed my apprenticeship. That is so cool. That is wow. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And you know, you were so cute because I think you were a little bit unsure of being the translator, but you did a great job, and everybody just loved you, you know.
Yeah.
And your grandmother, oh my goodness, she was a remarkable woman.
Yeah.
Growing up with her must have been really amazing. Well, and your father too. Was it a little bit intimidating growing up around so much spiritual wisdom and power?
Well, for me, that was natural. It was my family. To me, growing up, that was like something that was natural. And, you know, watching my grandmother do her speeches and lectures, like the one you were at, and then watching her do her healings, and watching my grandpa also teach with her, and then watch my father during his transition, you can say, from when he began his apprenticeship with my grandmother to watching him blossom into the man he is now. So for me, growing up in it was magical because, you know, when you grow up with your grandmother and father, regardless of whose family it is, it's always wonderful to be able to have that connection with people in life that love you so much. So for me, that was the normal. That's the norm. And
yes.
Growing up, like, I had the juxtaposition of not only my dad being a doctor and my grandmother being a faith healer, that, you know, they have from the medical healing and the tradition of our family, but also going into school and academics, you know, you saw how other people live life. And the contrast was there when I had to explain it to my friends what my family did. And it all depended, because when I lived in Mexico, I was born in the States, but I lived briefly in Mexico. It was kind of strange to tell them that my grandmother was a curandera, because at the time, it was kind of a taboo thing. And sometimes, you know, you don't, it's kind of strange. Sometimes people are very positive in receiving, some people weren't. And as I got older and into the 90s, it became simpler, because people began to read my dad's book. And in reading his book, it was a lot easier to explain. But my grandmother was wonderful. You know, she ended up being in the San Diego Women's Hall of Fame, and she really contributed so much to the community that, having grown up with that, you can say that the part that I learned the most is the essence of what we do is in helping our community in the way we can. So what I do for myself is that I continue in the lessons that my grandmother taught me. I'm not a faith healer myself. I learned the lessons she taught, as well as my dad. So in bridging also what I learned from my friends and society and pop culture, because the thing about our tradition is that it's an oral tradition. It gets passed through generation, from Don Ezequiel to his son Don Leonardo, from his daughter, my grandma Sarita, to her son Don Miguel, and now to me and my brother Jose. Every generation tells it uniquely, and it says it in a way that's relevant to our lives. So to me, that was growing up in my family. I got to see two ways of living life, and it was so cool.
Yes, and you know, for your father to have been in the medical field for so many years, adhering to medical knowledge and practice as it is practiced here in Western culture, those were really very different. You know, he really lived in two different worlds.
Yeah.
And but you know what I found, or what I've observed about walking the spiritual path, is that once you've set foot on it, it supersedes all other roads. It's like it somehow all the other roads come into that path, and it all becomes that path. And yes, it's like no matter if we try to rebel or we think, well, no, we're going to go in this other direction, somehow whatever path we take always winds back and joins the spiritual path again. And it's a very powerful walk, isn't it?
Well, actually, like, you know, in what you're saying there, like, there's an element that, to your first question about what was it like to being grown up, the one thing I have a contrast, is that even growing up in a spiritual family like mine, I still got domesticated. I still got attached. I still distorted the lesson. You can say that I domesticated myself to the conditions of living up to being my father and my grandmother's son or grandchild. Mm-hmm. You can say that where a lot of people are searching for something to help, to find that instrument that allows them to understand the world. Imagine growing up as that instrument being your domestication. And all of a sudden, I'm using this knowledge in order to flip it on myself. So you can almost say that one of the things in my life is discovering that I had to detach from the tradition. I had to detach from my own domestication and my own perception of it in order to clean it out. You can say that, for example, when I was, my father released the book, the four levels of the four agreements, sorry. And someone started asking me, well, when is your book coming out? And I'm like, in 21, 22, when it came out. Then all of a sudden, the pressure's already there. And since I developed a personal importance, I developed an ego, and I even developed a certain amount of attachment to the concept. The ego spoke, and it says, well, I will soon. But the thing about it is that as I discovered what I was doing, you know, for example, the four agreements, I was using the four agreements as the four conditions of my own self-acceptance. If I live up to the expectation of don't take things personal, always do your best, don't make assumptions, and be skeptical but learn to listen and be impeccable with the word, all five of them, in living up to the image of being Don Miguel Ruiz's son, I distorted it and I turned it into the conditions of my own self-acceptance. So when I first began this process, I saw it from that point of view, and as I began to let go to really work, all of a sudden, I began to clean it out. I began to no longer use it as my domestication and started using them as instruments for my transformation. Mm-hmm. So for me, you can say that in another way to answer your question before, what was it like to grow up in a family and combine it with a part where everything goes back to spirituality? What happens when someone grows up in that spirituality and distorts it? And then the challenge there is to undistort it and reapply it in the same way. For example, when my dad published the book in 1997, I picked up the book and I put it back down because this is my dad telling me what to do all over again. Then
yes.
And then in 2002, I picked it up again as I was going through my own transition. And all of a sudden, there were instruments instead of conditions. I began to read it the way other people read it, the way everyone else outside in the world who's looking for something, all of a sudden I read from that point of view, I'm like, oh, I get it. This is it.
Yes.
And
yes.
I'm no longer distorting it. So you can say that the premise of the book, the Five Levels of Attachment, is that I'm basically describing that journey, you know, how to this, to like when I began to attach myself to it and find myself that I'm at level four, I've internalized the information, how to let it go. So with each level, which is level one, the authentic self, level two, preference, level three, identity, level four, internalization, and level five, fanaticism, each one represents an attachment of how I've distorted knowledge, or you can simply say how I let knowledge control me. And if I translate it to a Toltec tradition, it's the story of Tezcatlipocatl, the smoking mirror. But in essence, it's about recovering my authentic self, or we can say my awareness of the authentic self, because I'm always a living being. I'm always alive. And for as long as I'm alive, everything is possible. And that's the thing about remembering. So to me, that's beautiful.
Yes, and see, you had to almost rebel a little bit in order to find your own original medicine, because we can only, our power is in our own original medicine, which you're now bringing out, and so that's awesome.
Yeah.
In your book, you say that we're constantly explaining, justifying, and judging our lives instead of living the experiences for what they are, and that we create a story to make it fit our beliefs. Mm-hmm. Would you expand on that a little bit?
Well, sure. When we grow attached to knowledge, you know, that was the question my grandmother asked, and the example of the translation is exactly it. You know, when I was translating for her and I was having problems, that was my apprenticeship to translate for her. She would turn to me and says, Miguel, do you know why you're having problems with the translation? And I said, you're going too fast. You're not giving me enough time. She says, are you using knowledge or is knowledge using you? Of course, at the time, I had no idea what she was talking about. But she said, what just happening is that you're listening to my words and you're processing inside your mind. In your mind, you're processing the words. You're finding what the right word or what the appropriate word is. And when you find it, you'll say it. The problem is that when you're listening to that process, you're no longer listening to me. So by the time you realize where I'm at, I'm so far ahead that you are falling behind. If you do that same thing with life, continuously translating the world as is and processing in your mind what should be, then what happened is that you're no longer seeing life for what it is. You're listening to what life is described in your own mind, and it's completely distorted. You're no longer living life. You're no longer paying attention to life. And when you're aware of that, you can make a choice. And my grandma says, imagine her voice being the voice inside my mind And as I hear it, I can open my mouth to say the word. And I got so much better at it. But the thing about it is that's the way my grandmother taught me how to quiet the mind, to learn to listen to life as is and understand the separation between me and my knowledge, or you can say me and my mind. So when I say, when we have the attachment to our filters, to what we know, it totally begins to distort how we see life based on our attachment. So you can say, like, if I answer it with the same question of, do I control knowledge or does knowledge control me? And I apply it to each one of the levels. At level one, yes, the answer would be, I am aware of my authentic self. I am life. I am aware that I am a living being. And for us, and my knowledge is alive because I am alive. At level two, the answer is, I am still aware of my authentic self, that I am alive, but I'm going to use knowledge as the instrument by which I am going to manifest life in the preference I want, in the direction I want in life. At level three, the answer is, I use knowledge to identify myself. I basically find a knowledge and understanding of the world, but I also use it to understand me. I identify with what I know. At level four, I use knowledge to give me the rules of and conditions of my own acceptance. Living up to the expectations of what knowledge tells me I should be. And at level five, fanaticism, knowledge completely controls my every action because it's a rigid structure of my own self-acceptance based on what I know. Thus, I will reject anything that's going to contradict it. So with each level, it's a way of how we use knowledge and how we, with each level we begin to distort it. Between level one, two, and three, knowledge, we let knowledge be what it is, which is an instrument or a symbol that allows us to understand the world and each other. It allows us to see how the universe functions. It allows us to see what previous generations have to teach us. And also it allows us to see how each one of us sees the world. But at level four and level five, we become so attached to our knowledge that we begin to distort it based on our personal importance, based on our ego, and we begin to corrupt it. We begin to make it fit what we want it to be. And thus, it becomes a battle of whose definition is right, whose definition is wrong. And when I'm so attached to it, of course I need to be right, and I'm going to fight anyone who does. So in that level of attachment, I'm totally distorting everything and I'm making it fit what I think it should be. Because the thing about knowledge, just like if you look at the very basis of word, this symbol, this knowledge, is completely subject to agreement. In order for it to be real or functional or have a meaning that we want, we have to agree on what the meaning is. In some words, you know, you describe an object like a table, a bed, a shirt, something that we can point to, that's it. And because we have a visual reference, we can say that's what that word means. But then there's words that we can't actually have tangible. It's abstract ideas and concepts that only exist by our agreement of it. You know, one of those things, though we feel it, we have our own definition of what love is. And when we have, when we attach ourselves to our definition of what love should be, sometimes we totally get it distorted. My father always says, I am responsible for what I say. I am not responsible for what you hear. Meaning because, for example, the word soda in California means a drink. Whereas if I say soda in Utah, where my wife is from, they don't understand that word. For them, it's pop. You know, or the word, like, every word has their own meaning to each community, and it's completely subject to that community. So when you have something that's volatile like that, then when we're completely attached to it, like in level five, we're going to fight for that definition. We're going to argue to say that we're right and you're wrong, because my way of doing things is the right way. And it's a consequence of domestication, which is a system of reward and punishment. When we live up to the expectation, the reward is acceptance. When we don't live up to it, we have our punishment, which is our self-judgment. Since we are emotional beings, acceptance feels like love, and the rejection feels like the opposite of that. So the main motivator that gives strength to fanaticism is not hate, anger, and prejudice. Those are just factors of the core feeling, which is conditional love, a severe form that can even take you to the point where an idea is more important than my life. And if it's more important than my life, it's more important than someone else's. So when I said that in the book about how the filters of our lives can distort our the way we see everything, it's because in our attachments to the information that we receive, which is our knowledge, we will distort it, we will corrupt it, and we won't ever be able to see life as is, because we're only listening to what our mind is telling us. That lesson of my grandmother was telling me about translating. If I'm completely in my own mind, then I'm going to completely impose that image onto everything and everyone I know. But if I become aware that I'm doing that, and I decide to make a choice to let go of that attachment and recognize the truth of where I'm at, it allows me to make a choice. Do I want to stay here, or do I want to let go? Mm-hmm. And at that moment, we have the choice of letting go and seeing life as is. As we move down the levels of attachment, we begin to let go of the conditions of our own self-acceptance. As we let go of level 5 and we let go of level 4, we begin to see life as is. Because when we accept ourselves for who we are, the search for truth is based on looking for the truth and the answer, whether it's good or bad, or we would like it or not, we will accept it. But when we look for truth, but we distort it with the search for being right, then we will distort everything to fit what we want to see. And that's what creates all of this harmony in the world.
Yes, I believe that. I know that people, you tend to call it knowledge. I tend to think of it as belief systems. Mm-hmm. People create their reality with their perception of, and they form these belief systems that then they become very attached to because that's comfortable to them. That's safe. They have created this reality of world, and this is the way it is. Yeah. And they, and they don't want anybody to shake it up by saying, well, it's not really exactly like that. It could be like this. And they're, no, this is the way it is. Yeah. And I think they're afraid of change. So many people are just absolutely terrified of change. But we don't grow unless we change, right?
Well, exactly, because life is always evolving. Life is always changing. Even the truth is continuously changing. You know, it was the truth that it was winter. Now it's the truth that spring is coming. You know, it's 20 days away. So right now, the truth is it's winter, but in a few weeks, the truth is that it's not. And right here, since I was in LA, right now, right here, the truth is that it doesn't feel like winter. It feels like spring somewhere else in the world. And the thing about it is that as life progresses, the truth evolves and changes. But when we become so attached to something, an idea and a belief, then the one thing we don't want it to ever happen is for it to change. Because if it changes, what does it say about me? What happens to me if I'm wrong? What happens to me if all this, what I believe, is no longer really truth? Then that we're afraid of the unknown. And the thing about it is that with knowledge, you know, we're referring to the mind. In our belief system, at the very root of every single belief that conforms that system, that says that's me, at the very root of it, there is a yes. I'm the one saying yes to each and every one of them. There might be in my belief system a no, but I'm saying yes to that no. I'm saying yes to that negativity. I'm saying yes to that positivity. And at the core of it, there is that separation between me and knowledge. I'm the one who's saying yes, and at any given moment, I can change my mind and say no. And when I say no, I can change an agreement. I can change a condition. I can change the way I see the world. And the moment of awareness is that what gives every single belief life is me. Me, life, has said yes to that agreement. And for as long as I believe in it, it will be truth until I no longer believe in it. And at that moment, that filter that blinded me no longer exists. And that's what's so beautiful about it, because we can easily get attached to anything, politics, spirituality, even homeopathic remedies. I can say with the juxtaposition of my dad being a medical doctor and my grandmother being a faith healer, you know, you can say that I could become fanatical on one side or the other. And all of a sudden, I'm going to hate my father or I'm going to hate my grandmother because they represent the other side. But if you embrace them and listen to both sides, if you listen to Western medicine, if you listen to homeopathic remedies, then it tells us a truth, which is in life, we have so many choices. And I'm free to choose the one that's actually going to help me. Because if I'm so attached to homeopathic remedies and I'm so against antibiotics or anything Western, then I have a disease that homeopathic remedies can't help, then, and I'm going to say no to the Western, then I've just allowed my knowledge to control my choice, and I miss out on it. And the same could be with the opposite. If I'm so attached to the Western medicine, and there's something that's going to really help me with homeopathic remedies, but I'm going to say shun it because I'm so attached to my belief, then I've basically negated myself a choice. My belief completely controlled it. But if you see it from a totally different point of view and say, you know, both sides are a creation of man that allowed us to understand what we have around. One is based on nature, and one of us is finding another way with our imagination, with chemistry. But each one of them is a choice. So when I'm sick, I have all these options, and I can look at every single option and say, this one is the one for me, or this one is the right for me. And if I take it and I say, you know what, I don't like it, I'll change my mind. That's what's so beautiful about life. In life, there's always these possibilities that allows us to live, to allows us to survive, to allows us to really engage. And if we let our attachment blind us, we may miss out. But the beautiful thing about it is, if I see homeopathic remedies and Western medicine as part of my potential, I'm free. I'm completely free to choose.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's and so cool.
Yes, we have to learn to allow other points of view and allow other perceptions and acknowledge that truth can be in all of these things. It isn't just one way. Yeah. And, you know, the more attached we become to our beliefs, the more we actually limit ourselves and our ability to perceive something different and to be able to grow and change and evolve as we should. Yeah. Because we're in a state of constant, we're a work in progress, you know, we're in a state of constant change and growing and evolving. So I love your concepts.
Oh, thank you. You can say that we're living a never ending masterpiece that's always in progress with every stroke, with every chisel, with every brush and eraser. We're continuously evolving something that's perfect. Meaning by that, life is perfect, and it never stops production. It's always moving. And being aware of that allows us to see life from a totally different point of view.
Yes, that's so true. And I hope a lot of people are really getting this because it's so important. It has become so easy in our culture to get locked into a concept that this is the way things are. This is all there is to it. This is the way it is. And we have to be able to get out of the box and see a bigger picture and be able to accept that there are maybe other viewpoints and other perceptions and other ways of doing things than what we're doing right now. Yeah. So that's great. How did you manage to break it down into these five levels that
Well, my grandmother introduced the concept to me, and the way she described it was through angels and demons. basically in a very Catholic way, you know, the almost similar to Dante's Inferno, and how when we attach ourselves to something, you know, it goes from divinity to hell. But to me, when she was describing it to me, it sounded like history. It sounded like something not really tangible in my life. So the way I finally saw it was in my own truth, in my own attachment, which, you know, I'll say the story of the five levels of attachment. You know, imagine you like soccer, which is how I saw it. It made sense to me. You might not be able to relate with it if you don't like soccer or sports, but listen out. It might be good. Imagine at level one, I can go to any stadium in the world. It could be the most beautiful place, or it could be a dirt field place. But if there's someone playing a game of soccer, I will sit down and I will engage that moment. I'm not going to cheer for one side or the other. I'm going to see the beauty of this moment. But when the game ends, when the referee blows his or her whistle to end it, I stand up and I live my life. That moment was a moment in the past, and I let go. I detached. Mm-hmm. I am living life, and I can free to attach and engage and detach as life progresses. I am pure life. At level two, preference, I can still go to any stadium in the world, and whether it be beautiful or a dirt field, I've realized that if I invest a little of myself, then the emotional roller coaster would be bigger. And when it's bigger, the event itself is more exciting. So I will pick a team based on a color I like, the last name of a player, especially if it's Ruiz, or the name of the street or wherever they're from. Mind you, I'm not choosing to root against the other team. I'm just going to root in favor of this one because that's going to be my preference. And I choose to attach. And as the game engages, I'm going up and down with the good and the bad of the game. It's exciting. But when the game is over, I detach. I take back the investment of myself because I have complete awareness that I am life. And I can detach, stand up, and continue to live life because the moment is no longer with me. At level three, I begin to identify myself with my team. It could be from Tijuana, it could be from San Diego, it could be from Los Angeles, it could be from Barcelona. But I begin to wear the colors of my team, and I start calling myself a fan. Now, mind you, just like level one, level two, and level three, when the referee blows his or her whistle to end it, I stand up. But when level three, I carry the image and the colors outside of the moment. I begin to take it to other parts of the world. I begin to introduce it to my friends. Now, mind you, it's not a condition of my acceptance of my friendship with my people in my life. They're free to not like soccer. In fact, I can go to a soccer pub and watch a game, and I can see fans of rival teams. And I says, hey, you like this team? I'll buy you a beer. And you can engage them and interact with them. Just because I've identified myself with this team is not a condition by which I begin to impose it on my other people in my life. But at level four, I begin to internalize this team. This team now defines who I am. And to be a good fan, I have to live up to the expectation. In fact, I begin to take it outside the game. If the team loses, I've got bragging rights for a whole week. If the team wins, I've got bragging rights for the whole week. If we lose, I have to pay for that. But I begin to try to convince my friends to be soccer fans, to convince them that, you know, this is a good way of living life, and you should be that. And I begin to use domestication to impose that onto them because I'm using domestication to internalize this image. But instead of buying a beer to those two fans that are of their team, I'm not going to buy them a beer. I'm going to fight with them. I'm going to argue with them. And that's the internalization. At level five, fanaticism, I live and breathe this team. There's no one in my life that doesn't like soccer. In fact, they all have to be my fans of my team. And if my son is a fan of another team, he's out. And I got so obsessed. Whether the referee blows the whistle to end or start the game, it doesn't matter. I'm a fan through and through. If we win, yeah. If we lose, there's always a conspiracy theory to justify why we lost. The referees were sold and everything is here and there. But also the players represent me. You can say that as there's a line that separates what happens on the field and me. At level one, the line between the field and me is completely separate, and I'm completely aware of it. At level two, I'm still aware of that separation, but I begin to invest a little bit of myself on that team, but I'm able to take it back. At level three, that line that happens on the field is began to blur. I begin to see myself in what's happening in that field. At level four, the line is completely blurred, and it's basically me. I'm the 12th or 13th, I'm a member of that team, and we won. Mm-hmm. At level five, there's no difference. And the thing about it is that when we get so attached, the colors of my uniform, of my team, become more important than my life. So it's easy to kill someone or kill myself if my team doesn't do good and I want my team to do right. You know, and in England, there's something called relegation. If a team gets sent down, does really poorly in a season, it gets sent down to the lower division. And a few years ago, a very big team got relegated. A young man left the pub, went home, and hung himself because he couldn't bear his team to be in the lower division. That same year, there was a fan whose team lost the Champions League, and he saw four fans of the other team that won and got so mad that he rammed the bus that he was driving onto them and killing all four, all because they were wearing the wrong color. The thing about it is that I'm using soccer and sports because, of course, it's trivial. It's the game has nothing to do with us. You can see the separation between me and them. But if we combine it, if we translate it to religion, to politics, to homeopathic remedies and spirituality, then all of a sudden it's not so silly anymore. All of a sudden it becomes more serious. And you can see that transcended. You know, in religion at level one, you can go to any church, any temple, any mosque, any synagogue, any drum circle, and you will always find the love and grace of God because it's a pure expression of love for God. Mm-hmm. But at level five, God just happens to be the deity that the religion prays to. The religion is more important than God. So you can say in that those two extremes, you can say that somewhere in between we find ourselves. In our level of attachment. And to me, this is how I figured out my grandmother's lesson, that all of a sudden where she described it from divinity to demons and hell, I saw it from an extreme like for a game to the more point of distortion of a game. And I saw it in myself. And the thing, when my father and my grandmother taught me about detaching, the question was always, detach from what? Detach from... And so the thing about it is that with each level of attachment, it's an instrument to allow us to understand where we are at this very moment. And when we find ourselves that we're level four or five or three, and we recognize that that's where we're at, the moment to change is the moment of accepting our truth. This is what I've created. This is the result of my agreement. And I have a choice. I can continue to do this, or I can let go. And to me, that's the instrument of the levels of attachment. Now, is the goal to be at level one? Well, that's the thing. When I first started writing this book, I really believed that level one was the manifestation of a holy person like the Dalai Lama or Sai Baba or someone like that. And then I realized that's actually part of the truth. In reality, we're all the authentic selves, every single one, even at the thickest form of our attachment at level five, we're at level one because that life force gives life to that attachment. So the question at level five is that my awareness is so closed off that I don't see my authentic self. So you can now see awareness like a flower. And we can use each level to describe that a level one awareness is completely open because we have complete awareness of me life and a complete acceptance of I am this life force, that I'm using the symbol of authentic self. And as I go up the level of attachment, the flower begins to close, closing off our awareness of what's around us, closing up to the point where at level four, to the point where at level five, it closes completely, and we only see, like a blinders on a horse, we only see what our agreements let us see, and the whole world has been distorted, or we can't even see it, until that we have that aha moment. Like an alcoholic or a drug addict that has that moment of clarity. When we have in our life, we have that aha moment where we're all of a sudden we are aware of our own creation. We go, wow, I am alive. And we see our moment of truth, and we have this minimal opportunity to make a choice in that awareness before we step in unconscious again. Is I have a choice. I can stay here at this level, or I can let go. What drives us down to let go of our attachment is the willingness to say, I want this. This is what I want. Because if I say I have to, then I'm going to re-domesticate myself with another image, and I'm going to re-distort everything. This is how I can easily distort the four agreements and turn it into the four conditions of my self-acceptance. I can read a book like my dad's. I can read a book like Deepak. I can read a book like Wayne Dyer. And each one of them, and I can read the Bible, I can read the Quran, I can read the Old Testament, and each one of them teaches us how to let go and to live life. But if we are so attached to our domestication, then we're going to corrupt that too. But the way to let go is to say, I want to let go. I want to live my life. And the root is, at the very core, forgiveness, which is the acceptance of my truth and letting go. To forgive myself, to forgive anyone in my life whose word I've used to domesticate myself, to ask for forgiveness if I've harmed someone. But in the end, in that forgiveness, I forgive myself, because at the moment I realize that I'm the one who said yes to this attachment, I'm the one who did it, then that moment of forgiveness is the moment I let go. And I'm no longer going to corrupt knowledge, because judgment day has come, the day when I no longer judge myself. I let go of domestication. And that's how I came to those agreements. I came to that realization of the lesson of my grandmother. How old is it? Did it start with my grandmother? Did it start with an Ezekiel? I don't know. But I do know that my grandmother shared with me, and I translated it into a language I'm able to understand. And now I'm sharing it with everyone. Just like my brother Jose, me, and my dad, we all teach in the way that we understand the world.
Yes.
And we share it in a way that means something. That's what makes it alive. Otherwise, it'll be just a textbook in history and without any real meaning. But even a history book can teach us the actions and the decisions of our past that we can use at this very moment. And that's the key. At this very moment, the awareness that I'm using knowledge as an instrument for my own transformation allows me to take knowledge from being the tyrant in my life, the parasite that my dad talks about in the Four Agreements, and turn it into the ally, because I no longer need to distort knowledge. Because knowledge by itself is the most beautiful thing we have, because we can use it to create the bridge that's going to allow us to construct the dream of us. In communicating the way you and I are right now, we're constructing a beautiful dream.
Yes.
And that's what's so cool.
Yes, it's wonderful, and I love your concepts and the way you express them. I see in our culture a lot of what I call an identity crisis, that people don't know who they are, and so they're afraid to accept themselves as they are, because they have all these layers of expectations of their parents, prophecies of their teachers, of what they could or couldn't do, things in the work place that say this is how you will become an excellent executive someday. You do this and this and this. Mm-hmm. And so they have all these pictures all around them of what they could or should be, mm-hmm. and they don't know how to get back into their heart and find out who they are and to be able to accept themselves as they are. Mm-hmm. And I think that your book with these levels is laid out beautifully and will help a lot of people to be able to perhaps perceive themselves in a different light and be able to let go of some of those false images that have been put around them.
Thank you. Well, to me, one of the things about life is that while there's life, there's always infinite possibilities. There's always a chance of anything happening at any given moment, because while there's life in this body, while there's life in all of us, we can make a choice. And that's the beautiful potential. Yeah, if we grew up in a place that domesticated us pretty harshly, or that they really, really pushed that thing, we will believe an idea for as long as we believe in it. But the moment we stop believing in it, it no longer is the truth. The truth exists whether we believe in it or not, but a belief only exists while I believe in it. So if I believe in the conditions of my own self-acceptance, if I believe that the only way to be happy is if I reach those things, thy will be done. It will be true until I no longer believe it. Mm-hmm. And when we no longer believe it, we say, well, what's next? Well, anything is possible. Mm-hmm. And all that's required is for you to say, this is what I want to manifest in my life. And while there's life, I can manifest it, be it through the traditions of our ancestors in Latin America, or the ancestors in South Asia, the ancestors in Africa, in Europe, or everywhere else. We are continuously constructing the dream of us. It's up to us whether we construct the most beautiful dream together or we construct the most perfect nightmare. But at the very root of it, becoming aware that the only thing I control is me, my own individual dream. And that's the most beautiful thing, because in recognizing that I don't control my brother, my dad, my son, my daughter, my wife, allows me to respect them for who they are. When I'm able to recognize that they're their own free will and that I only control myself, then at that moment I have a choice. I can continue to believe in the conditions of my own self-acceptance if that's what I want, or I can let go. Like my brother Jose, I'm going to quote him, if I think in negativity, then I will have negativity. If I want positivity, I'll say positivity. The actions of those things will represent that. And I am that force. You can say that if we have an identity crisis, well, here's the thing about identity. An identity is an empty symbol whose definition is subjugated to my agreement. And I'm the one who's saying yes to that agreement. It's up to me.
Yes. Yes, we get to choose, and we have to have the courage to choose and be able to stand up and say, this is who I am.
Yeah.
Don Miguel, we're almost out of time. Your book is available on Amazon.com and through any bookseller, right?
Yes.
And okay, and what is your website if people would like to go there and check your schedule and everything?
Yeah, my website is MiguelRuizJr.com, and my dad's website is MiguelRuiz.com. And then my brother also has a cool one called TheUniverseOfNow.com. And all three of us love to manifest in our own way. And in my dad's calendar, he has a calendar for all three of us. So,
oh, good.
Okay. Yeah, so basically for us, information, those are the three main ways.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your beautiful wisdom with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on your show. And I'm so happy that, you know, that you and I were there that moment in time.
Yes.
That was, 12 years ago. Wow.
Yeah, I know. But our paths may cross again. You never know. We're on a spiritual walk. It's been wonderful. I wish you so the best of everything and your success with your book. Okay, thank you.
And I wish you success to you. Thank you.
Thank you. And so that's it for today. For all my listeners, join me next week. Until then, may the sun kiss your face, may the waters bless your body, and may all nature sing in your presence.